Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:57 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 8th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I saw this graphic today where it was ranking, it was a Deutsche Bank graphic, ranking the outlook for the various different currencies. And this has been a big week for currencies. We've seen a number of emerging markets that have had to raise interest rates or intervene in the bond markets or the currency markets to support their respective currencies, because the strength of the US dollar has been putting pressure on dollar funding rates for a substantial number of countries, and most particularly those that have got a lot of US dollar debt. What I thought was particularly interesting was that the lira, the Turkish lira, is considered the world's cheapest currency by this metric, and it has been rallying over the last few days. Mexican peso is also considered cheap, but then you have to not only consider things like capital-based valuation or trade-based valuation or the weighted capital, you have to also consider governance. Standards of governance, something that David has said for decades, is that in emerging markets, governance is everything. But you can spin that out to the whole world. Governance is everything. And Turkey has got some serious deficits in terms of its governance. Mexico has got an election coming up in the not-too-distant future where there could be a left-wing populist is going to take power. And won't that be fun for NAFTA negotiations? And then you have the Philippines, where there is already a populist person in charge. Then what I found particularly interesting was that on this graphic, the Chinese renminbi is considered to be one of the most expensive currencies. And then you had Brazil, which is all the way down at the bottom there. Well, the central bank intervened in the Brazilian market today, not so much by raising interest rates, but by saying that they are more than capable of introducing more supply by flooding the market with currency swaps. So the real had got all the way down to test the 4 area to the dollar, and today represented a rather significant move. So that is a clear downward dynamic for the US dollar, and it would suggest that now there is a peak of at least near-term significance for the dollar against the real. When we look at the Turkish lira, then we had this very similar pattern of acceleration, and they've raised rates now at least a couple of times, and the lira has bounced pretty emphatically from around that 5 to the dollar level. But there are broad questions that need to be asked, because these measures by central banks are at least short-term in nature. But the much broader point is that in many respects, the US, the USA is exporting its monetary policy around the world. One of the reasons that you've got this upward pressure on yields is not simply because of rising potential inflationary pressures. It's because the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet, and they're also raising interest rates. They're the only central bank in the world that is doing both at the same time. This is quantitative tightening. Quantitative tightening is putting upward pressure on the dollar, and it is also putting upward pressure on government bond yields. Considering the fact that the Federal Reserve was the buyer of both first and last resort, then the fact that they are no longer buying and are in fact a net seller does suggest that there is now a supply deficit in the market, and it is only rational that you would anticipate that yields should rise into that kind of environment. If this were any other market we were talking about, there'd be no argument. But because it is the Treasury market, and because there is a yield involved, and because it is the benchmark against which just about everything else is valued, there's a massive argument going on about how high can yields go, what is the extent to which the natural interest rate has deteriorated over a number of years, is there inflation or not. But the much bigger point is that you have an excess of supply over demand. This is economics 101. It's pretty simple. As long as the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet, there is a net supply. There is net new supply coming into the market, and that's before we even begin to consider the fact that the fiscal stimulus that the U.S. has approved since January represents an additional source of supply coming into the market. Well, it is an interest rate, treasuries are an interest-bearing market. So we really do need to look at the consistency of the total return, because people don't just buy them for trading. They're also being bought as to lend some stability to a portfolio. But when we address the consistency of the trend from the early 1980s, well, let's just think about it in very simple terms. Let's set aside all of the other arguments that there are, because we could talk for hours about what the arguments are with regard to the bond market, and just ask simple filter questions. Describe the trend as if you're talking to a blind person. And if we're doing that, well, has the market trending or ranging? Well, it was definitely trending before, but there's definitely been a loss of momentum. What were the consistency characteristics? Well, the consistency characteristics were that it only went up until approximately 2016, and now we have the first lower high. Prior to that, every single occasion on which the market had pulled back had been a buy. If you had bought the market, then you were rewarded on the by buying the dip with a new high. And the only time that has not worked was in 2016. So that tells us that, well, what can we draw from that would be obviously the next question. Well, we would have to conclude that the supply and demand imbalance that resulted in this phenomenal bull market all the way through from the early 1980s until 2016 has changed. And if it has changed, it tells us that this market is no longer in a consistent trend. If it's not no longer in a consistent trend, well, is there evidence of top formation development? Well, we could argue yes, that there is potential that what this range that has now been going on since the beginning of 2016 is an evolving type 3 top formation, which we define as ranging time and size. It is a substantial range. We have had more volatility in the last few years than we'd had previously. We have it has been going sideways already for 3 or 4 years, and it's a big pattern. It's an awfully big pattern when we consider just how much the price had gone up, that it went from lows back in the early 1980s of in the order of 90 to approximately 100, and it is currently trading at 2000. So these are pretty simple percentages to work out. What I saw a very interesting article earlier this week, and it was saying that the market needs risk takers like Bill Gross. Well, it is precisely risk takers benefit most in a primary bull market, because if you have absolute faith in the bull market and you buy the dips without fail and stick to your strategy, you're going to be rewarded with outsized gains. And that works for as long as the bull market persists. And you will come out looking like a genius when the market has gone up 2,000%. And the chances are you will have done even better than that by buying the dips and taking on leverage and just going all in every single time. Then people tend to accrue massive fortunes. And that's exactly what we've seen happen in the bond markets. But if this market is topping and buying the dips no longer works, then what that represents is the death of the buy and hold, the death of the buy the dip strategy. It is no longer the risk takers that are going to make money from this market, but rather the people that are risk averse, those that are selling the rallies, those that are only buying when yields are not just a little attractive, but when they are absolutely compellingly attractive. And that is, I think, when we start to look at corollaries, rather than simply looking at the U.S. 10-year Treasury market and then starting to engage in these rather facile arguments about whether 3% is a meaningful level or 3.5 or 4%, but rather to take a much broader perspective and look at the consistency of the downtrend. And when we look at that consistency of the downtrend, then the trading between approximately 2011 and now looks different to what we saw previously. And it has the characteristics of base formation. So that's the most important point. Now, if we see a sustained move above 3%, then the argument for base formation completion will look more compelling. If we see it above 4%, well, then we're in a new uptrend. We're no longer talking about the bottom being in, but rather that there is a secular uptrend in yields and downtrend in prices. And that would be incredibly meaningful for the much wider market. Well, this is one of the more important points, because when we think about what is going on in this market, something that I've been reading up rather a lot recently on wages and the manufacturing sector. The manufacturing sector has collapsed, and it is and the it, in fact, it's not just that the manufacturing sector has collapsed. It is that the full extent of how much the manufacturing sector has evaporated, or I think perhaps even a better term for it would be eviscerated, in the USA and in the UK, is because of the influence of the technology sector. Even though the vast majority of manufacturing for computers already happens outside of both the US and the UK, and primarily in Asia, the deflationary impact that these sectors have masks the because the value added in the way that the or it, excuse me, the way that value added is calculated in the productivity of manufacturing is distorted heavily by the fact that the progress and innovation in the computer and chip manufacturing sector has improved so radically over the last 40 years that it has completely overshadowed the fact that manufacturing in just about every other sector has been in terminal decline, particularly since China entered the global economy through the WTO in the early 2000s. That the pace of manufacturing decline has accelerated since 2000, and that the number of jobs has being lost in manufacturing has increased by over 6 times in that particular interval. Then the question I was asking myself during this week is, well, we're looking at the average hourly earnings, and they have not been accelerating higher. Well, if we had a true I think revolution going on in the manufacturing sector, then that would help to would classically have helped for or helped this measure to break out. But the reality is that when we think about the fact that manufacturing as a percentage of the people working has declined so radically, then and we also know that the number of people that are unemployed has or that unemployment is at almost record lows. Well, what that represents, it I think that that's one of the most important factors in the calculation of why earnings or why wages haven't been going up faster. It's because the kinds of jobs that are being created are not higher paying jobs. That's the most important point. It's that if we had manufacturing jobs, which generally do tend to pay more, then the chances are that wages would be breaking out. But because a lot of the job growth that has occurred in the economy over much of the last decade, or most particularly in the recovery period from the credit crisis, has been in the service sector, then service sector jobs do not generally tend to pay as well as manufacturing jobs, and that has kept a lid on average hourly earnings. But because we are now at a period where we have very low unemployment. And because minimum wages are starting to rise, then that is starting to move the needle. That one of the I really strongly believe that the reason that we haven't had wages rising yet is because we don't have manufacturing in, as part of that calculation anymore, but because because unemployment is so low that it is largely inevitable that wages start to rise. And then we of course and there's a great graphic if we look at the really really long term for non-farm payrolls, we can see and this is the beauty of looking at long-term charts, and most particularly long-term charts of hard fundamentals. Because we can see that between about 1970 and really the end of the 1990s, yes, manufacturing was deteriorating, but it was pretty much holding steady. And then in the early 2000s, it collapsed. And what happened in the early 2000s? Well, very simply, China entered the global economy through the WTO. Manufacturing has been recovering since 2010, but generally speaking, manufacturing, and this was the other important point historically about manufacturing, and we see evidence of it in the data back in the 1970s, it was that it was highly sensitive to the economic cycle. So it went up faster in upswings and it fell faster during recessions. Well, it just fell for the decade between 2000 and 2010. Then we've had this phenomenal advance and one of the longer, the second longest expansion in economic history for the US economy. Well, in normal circumstances, manufacturing would have exploded on the upside with the length of that expansion, but that has not occurred because we have had this complete change in the global market. We've had an abrupt change where manufacturing has been largely exported. So, what is now occurring is that and this was something that I became acutely aware of when over a year ago when I spoke to the CEO of software, that they are producing robots that are going to be sewing garments, and they were anticipating that all of the demand would come from the USA, but that's not been the case at all because they don't even have one of the reasons that companies like Nike and Under Armour have all their factories overseas is because they have the infrastructure, both human and physical. So there are isn't the physical infrastructure, but you can build the physical infrastructure in the US. That wouldn't be a problem. It's the human infrastructure, the layer of middle management, the kinds of people who know how to manage a mid-sized to large factory just simply no longer exists. And that means that a lot of those robots are going to be exported. It also means that manufacturing is likely to stay overseas. And that is going to represent a key portion of disagreement between different countries. It really does suggest that the most likely scenario is that either we're going to have a wholesale renegotiation of the balance of trade between countries, or we're going to have trade wars, or we're going to have a much greater intensification in technology. And there is a race on who can automate first. So I think that's a rather important point. So there is, of course, the absolute possibility that we're all going to have all three. And if I had to bet, I would consider that that is the most likely scenario. Well, if we have trade wars and we already have zero unemployment, then the likelihood is that we are going to get an inflationary pressures starting to come through. And the very fact that the USA is exporting its monetary policy around the world does suggest that we're going to be moving towards higher interest rates just about everywhere. Eventually, that is going to contribute to an inverted yield curve. And The yield curve right now is at 44.8 basis points, and it is trending lower. At some point, it's going to become negative, and when it is negative, we'll have a 6 to 18 month lead time for the next recession. We can also anticipate, and it's already beginning, that there was going to be a rollicking debate about whether this is still going to be an efficient way of thinking about when we're going to have the next recession or not. Because I remember having that exact same argument back in 2005, 2006. It was the first time that I'd been exposed to the yield curve. But having read up extensively about it in the last decade, I'm pretty much convinced that it is going to continue to remain a very compelling lead indicator for future recessions. Then, if we look at the high yield sector. Well, the US high yield sector has been completely inert for a year and a half already, and it would really need to break out to suggest that we have some stress coming through in the market. So that also suggests that we are not anywhere near a recession right now. The one place where the high yield spreads are rising is in Europe. And when we look at that chart, and I'm bringing it up now, it's the Credit Suisse chart, then we can see that the high yield spread in Europe has broken out. So if we were to think about where are the risks, where is there a risk that we are moving towards a more difficult period for the bond markets, then it's in Europe that we have, I think, the most acute risk, if we think about where are some of the developed market risks right now. It's got to be in Europe. Well, we know what's happening in the emerging markets, and most particularly in places like Turkey and Brazil and Argentina, South Africa and Indonesia and India. These are places where the soft underbelly of the dollar funding is starting to be tested. India this week started to intervene in its currency market, raised rates in order to try and defend this low in the rupee that we've seen put in since 2013. And the rupee was a little bit weaker in towards the close in here today, and so far the RBI has tried to defend this level, and I don't anticipate that they're going to stop doing so. But until the matter is 100% resolved, I think we can anticipate that there's going to be some questioning of how much to expect on the upside from the Indian market. But I think the most important thing that the Indian market has done is bounce from the 10,000 level, and it has bounced from the region of the trend mean as well. So we have a higher reaction low, and as long as we have that higher reaction low, then there's probably not a great deal to worry about in terms of the stock market performance, at least in nominal terms. Going back to that graphic that I was looking at right at the beginning of this broadcast, I think it is interesting to look at the renminbi at this stage. It has now unwound its overbought condition relative to the trend mean versus the dollar. And this is a rather key area. Well, the Asia dollar index is in a very similar situation, and the renminbi has approximately the same influence on the Asia dollar index as the euro does on the US dollar index, and the ADXY is now right in the region of the trend mean. And a sustained move below it, well, that would then begin to raise the prospect that the dollar is not just in a short-term rally, but it is breaking the uptrend for Asian currencies that's been evident since the beginning of 2017. So this is a very important level, and if we do see it broken, then that is going to represent a headwind for the emerging markets. Something I was talking about in yesterday's video, and I think is really quite important, because what happened in Tencent today, I think, is rather important. It was looking really quite bullish yesterday, and then it pulled back by 14 Hong Kong dollars in here today. And again, if we look at the trend and the consistency, and simply explain it to a blind person, it trended beautifully higher in 2017. Then we had a larger reaction in December. It was a much larger reaction than we'd seen previously. That was a penultimate high, and it went up to new highs subsequently in January. Well, and it peaked in February. Well, the question that always comes up at the chart seminar is, we often see that very consistent trends peak at their penultimate, or that they have a loss of consistency at their penultimate high. And we always ask, well, why do you think that might be? And the general answer is that usually, when you have a much larger reaction, then that prompts some people to either get out or to stop buying, but there is still enough, usually, of retail buying to help to push it on to new highs. But there aren't enough of institutional buyers left to continue to push it on to even higher highs. Then it starts to run out of steam. And that is exactly what we've seen happen with Tencent. And Tencent is rather important because it is really a totem for the technology sector in China. There isn't anybody I know who doesn't use WeChat. It is as ubiquitous as Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram combined in China. So the fact that we have had this loss of consistency is, I think, rather important. The fact that it has not been able to capitalize on the bounce from the region of the trend mean isn't particularly encouraging. It really does need to hold those lows put in May. If it sustains a move below the trend mean, well, then we would have to conclude that the bull market is over for at least the medium term, and that it is going to require potentially some substantial convalescence before it can continue higher. We can see here that the estimated PE is 38, and that the historic PE is 39. What that is suggesting is that the market is not anticipating that there's going to be a big jump in earnings. And considering that it pretty much, well, it more than doubled in 2017, then there is certainly room for some consolidation. Then, when we look at the H share index, again, this had bounced very impressively from the region of the trend mean yesterday, but it gave up some of that advance in here today. And then, if we think about the consistency of this trend, then it trended really beautifully, consistently, and in a very rhythmic manner all the way from the beginning of 2016, and then it accelerated in towards the end of last year and the beginning of this year, and encountered resistance right at the upper side of what is effectively a 9-year range below about 14,000. And then it pulled back and has been ranging in a pretty volatile manner for much of the last 6 months. So it really does need to hold the region of the trend mean. Or then, if it fails, well, we would have to conclude that there's a realistic possibility it will go right back down and test the lower side of the range. And the lower side of the range is at 8,000. What happens at this level is, I think, r really quite pivotal for the Chinese market. Now, there are two ways of looking at what's going on in the market right now. We might rationalize the underperformance of some of the domestic shares in China because we're on the cusp of seeing the Chinese depository receipt market opening up, and that will be beneficial for the kinds of companies that are currently listed overseas coming back to have a secondary listing at home. And some money may be taken off the table now in anticipation of being able to buy shares like Alibaba later. But the underperformance of the Shanghai Property Index, I think, is quite notable, that it is now trending lower. And when we look at the banks sector, well, we know that the banks are arms of the government, but they are trending lower. And generally speaking, when we think about banks, and there is something that is applicable to just about all markets, banks tend to do well in a bull market because they're liquidity providers, and bull markets thrive in a liquidity-fueled situation. Well, if banks are underperforming, then it tells us that liquidity is being drained from the market. And if liquidity is being drained from the market, then we would have to question whether there is a bull market. And that's, I think, a rather important point. Meanwhile, the technology sector, which I think Alibaba is the big one listed overseas, well, it broke out to new highs earlier this week, and so far it has held the move above 200. But it really does need to hold that move above 200. If we get a failed upside break, then that is going to take it back below the trend mean. And considering just how much it had rallied from that the lows just before the move in January of last year, then we would have to be considering whether this isn't a potential top formation development if it fails. So what happens next, I think, is really rather important. Then one of the best performing shares has been the education sector, that with and the state exams started this week, so TAL Education was pushing on to new highs again in here today, considering that there are millions and millions of kids that need to be educated, and it's a highly competitive domestic market. This does represent a rather bullish environment, but this share is now accelerating once more. Then, when we think about what the big questions are with regard to China, well, some of them have to do with the fact that that governance really is everything, and one of the at the country opinion club, or the contrarians dinner, I should say, last week, then one of the points that somebody made was that on the econometric method that he employs, that Russia and China were the ones that kept hitting the market in terms of their relative discount compared to everything else. But there is a reason why they have a relative discount. It's because of the lack of governance. We generally tend to think about governance as three simple characteristics. You need to have respect for minority shareholder interests. You need to have an independent judiciary, and you need to have a free press. That way, if somebody tries to usurp your minority shareholder interests, you can take them to court, and the story can be published in the press so that lots of other people get to hear about it, and you have a better chance of having your case heard. Well, China doesn't have any of that, whereas India has all of it. And then you have varying degrees of questions in various other markets. One of the reasons that Turkey is under such pressure is because standards of governance are under attack. One of the reasons that the South African market has held up somewhat better is because you've had an improvement in governance there, and the one redeeming feature of the I think, well, perhaps not the one redeeming feature. The most important redeeming feature, I believe, in the South African market is the freedom of the judiciary. Well, then when we think about China, not only do they have none of those three characteristics, but they now are a dictatorship, and there is outright warfare going on the freedom of association. So it isn't simply that they don't have tick marks in their favor. There are two additional tick marks that are lacking favor. And these are the kinds of problems that people are willing to look past when the price is rising. But when the price is falling, then people tend to get really animated about governance. And then the big question is that when we look at some of the smaller banks, then, and I think it is important to look at the A shares rather than the Hong Kong listings, then smaller banks are where the majority of the focus of the shadow banking sector is, and most of them are not listed. There are going to be more IPOs, and there is the realistic possibility that we will see the market judge the outlook for some of these smaller banks. But for example, China Merchants Bank could be considered a smaller bank, and it is now right in the region of its trend mean. So having done really spectacularly well from the latter half of 2017, this has been a substantial loss of momentum. Now, when we start to think about what the outlook is and think about the longer term, there are three major themes. One is the rise of the middle class, but the question then is, how is that going to be affected by the rise of trade tensions and geopolitical pressures? And that remains an open question, but perhaps the most likely scenario is that we move into a multipolar world, and that there is going to have to be a negotiated settlement between the evolving center of gravity that China represents in the Asian region versus the evolving center of, or the, well, it's the already massive center of gravity that the US market represents. China is investing heavily in not only its military. It could be argued right now that they are spending more on their military than the US if you strip out labor costs. And that's a significant development. Then we have to also consider that the US is now the world's largest producer of oil, and China is a net purchaser. So there is the possibility that there's going to be some form of negotiated settlement where China will end up buying more of the USA's oil and will end up paying dollars for it. That could help to ease a lot of tensions. But then the question is whether that is even remotely realizable. One thing that China is doing rather aggressively is investing in trying to both secure the commodities it needs to fund its expansion and its innovation, and also it's investing heavily in efficiency to try and reduce the intensity with which it is using energy. When we look at the very long-term charts for oil prices, well, then we can go back 100 years, and we can see that it moves in these very long-term cycles. And these cycles tend to be very lengthy. That generally speaking, the bull markets last about a decade, and the bear markets last for decades. So oil prices are still really quite steady around the $70 area. And then when we look at this long-term chart, we can see that we had a big bull market, and that the hallmark of these big bull markets is that you get a rise in the marginal cost of production. And the marginal cost of production now is approximately $40, whereas it represented a peak in the previous cycle. It's now a floor. So it's unlikely we're going to see prices sustained below $40, but it's also unlikely that we're going to see a sustained move above $100 for at least the next 10, if not 20 years. And then we'll probably get the next bull market. I think when, but that is a significant long-term projection. But if this pattern holds true, then that's what we can anticipate. There are some incredibly exciting things happening in the global markets for energy right now. Battery technology is improving rapidly, and I thought it was particularly interesting at the earnings call for Tesla just a while ago that we saw the announcement that they were now employing 8-to-1-to-1 ratios for nickel, manganese, and cobalt in their batteries. It was completely overshadowed by the fact that that Elon Musk called the analyst community on Wall Street boring. But cobalt has been one of the phenomenal bull markets of the last few years. I'm very much reminded of the uranium market. And when we look at the longer-term trend in terms of the price of cobalt on a point-and-figure chart, then we get this incredible advance where it simply went up. It just went up and never went down until April. And then we had a point-and-figure reversal. Well, when something goes straight up, then the likelihood is that when it comes down, it is probably going to come down with a bang. If we zoom in to maybe just the last 5 years and look at it on a daily basis, then we can see that by reducing the size of the box, then we get these little reactions. And there were reactions along the way in terms of the price, but now we have this much larger reaction. So now it is dipping back into the previous range. So this is also looking rather tenuous when we look at the price. And when we look at the price, we have now had the largest reaction on the candle chart that we have seen since at least 2015, but it is coming from a much higher level. Now, this is as of yesterday's close, and I believe the price was up about $750 today. But what this suggests to me is that supply is starting to come through into the market, and the fact that now you're getting efficiencies coming through, that it is a really good example of the old adage in the market that the cure for high prices is high prices. And now you're getting battery efficiencies coming through that are using much less cobalt. They probably won't ever be able to remove cobalt entirely from the battery, but they can certainly reduce the intensity with which it is used. And this is all assuming that electric vehicles growth does in fact go according to plan. But what it also suggests is that nickel prices are probably going up, because if cobalt is coming down, then nickel prices should be rallying. And nickel prices have been rallying since July of last year, and they are now approaching the $16,000 level. And really, a sustained move below the trend mean would be required to question that this isn't still a recovery scenario. And you really do have to look at plenty of back history just to see how depressed those nickel prices were, that they were trading in the region of the 2008 and 9 lows as recently as the middle of last year. So there is ample potential for additional upside in the nickel market. That's thinking about where we are in terms of the innovations that are leading to the battery revolution. But batteries are an enabling technology, and I think that's one of the more important points, that when we think about the longer term outlook for the commodity markets and the technology markets, that there are key pieces of technology that are enabling. Because when we have this change in the technological outlook that is creating new technologies, then they don't necessarily have to stay within the battery or within the electric car battery sector. But when we think about robotics and all those wonderful videos that Boston Dynamics puts out, well, they never talk about how long those wonderful robots can actually perform for. Well, they could perform for a lot longer if the batteries had more energy density. Then just this week you had I thought this the we've been waiting for years for the announcement of the flying car. And then you had this story coming out yesterday for the Kitty or Larry Page's Kitty Hawk, and it can fly for something like 10 minutes, and it can achieve something like 10 feet above the air. Sorry, above water, because they are recommending that you only fly it above water, because when it eventually crashes, you might have some chance of surviving. Well, this would appear to be pretty unambitious, and the only way that they're going to get up to better flight times is if they do in fact get better batteries. So when I think about enabling technologies, then that is the kind of thing that immediately springs to mind, that it's going to be in robotics, it's going to be in cars, it's going to be in planes, that we're going to get all of these batteries taking place. Then there is the innovation that's going on in fusion, that For the longest time, people have been anticipating that fusion would be 30 years away. And now we're starting to see that people are talking about fusion being 10 years away and 7 years away. And there have been some key innovations that are making that happen. The ITER project in the south of France is going to take somewhere in the region of about 30 billion, and it's taking about 20 years to build it because the tokamak has got to be so large. That's how they are. That the tokamak technology is the one that has got the most data to back it up, so they decided that the only way to really get it to work was to build a really big one. That was the only way that they could make magnetic fields strong enough to contain the plasma. But supercapacitors have advanced at an alarming rate over the course of the last 40 years, so now it is possible, and I'm posting an article in Comment of the Day today, where a team in the UK have built a tokamak in a warehouse. And they're doing it for a fraction of the cost. MIT announced at the beginning of the year that they had closed down their original tokamak reactor and that they wanted to build a new one and that they thought that they could get net energy out of the reactor and do it within 7 years for a cost of less than $300 million. And that is 1% of the price for a $30 billion reactor. So, when you start to think about it in those terms, that technological innovation is really creating game changers within the energy sector. So, it is reasonable that when we look at the oil price over the very long term, that it could be ranging for a substantial period of time, that the potential is that we will see a secular change in demand for gasoline. And that there will be a secular change also then in the demand for transportation fuel. So that will create more different uses for oil, which will potentially feed through into plastics and materials more than into fossil fuels. It's going to create a really substantial change. And of course, then there is also the gas market. And there is going to be ample demand for gas for the foreseeable future. And I think it is interesting that Royal Dutch Shell has bounced from the 2600 point level, P level. So it has partially unwound its overbought condition and it continues to trend higher. And as long as it is holding and finding support in the region of the trend mean on reversions, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. As a majority gas producer rather than an oil producer, this is a rather key difference. One of the things that has weighed on the consumer staples sector has been the fact that yields have been rising. And what I find particularly interesting is that it isn't so much that their business model has been questioned. It's rather that they were bought for their bond-like characteristics and then they'd been sold because of their bond-like characteristics. But then it does look like now that they are starting to find support, but it is absolutely going to need to sustain a move above the trend mean to confirm a return to demand dominance. This has been, again, if we look at the consistency of the trend, this has been a meaningful pullback. It's a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and it has broken the progression of higher reaction lows, not just the last one, but the one before that too. So it is now for the bulls to prove. Now, when we think about bond-like characteristics in terms of cash flows, well, then we have had again a rather significant change in the markets. Because when we look at the business model that has been most effective in terms of streamlining cash flows, it's with the evolution of the subscription business model. I've created a section within the chart library for that, and you'll find it in the Owen's favorites section. It's the last one I created. Well, we can click through the constituents of that index. And when we do that, well, what we're presented with is consistent trends. When you get consistency in cash flows, you start to get consistent trends. Now, I think it's arguable that we certainly have some overextensions relative to the trend mean right now, but when you start to look at the consistency of these are the it's the internal consistency or commonality, excuse me, of the grouping that they are coming all from somewhere within the technology sector, and that they are delivering this beautifully consistent cash flow that is easily modelable, and that also is going to contribute to either their growth and potentially dividend growth over the medium to longer term. So it is the subscription business model which has come out on top in preference to the consumer staples sector. Now, when we think about the autonomies, well, there are autonomies that fit into both categories. I think that there is still a big place in the world for these very well-established global brands. We're also starting to see that companies like Starbucks are raising prices, that they are beginning to deliver these what is required of them to get investors interested once more. So I think the consumer staples sector is very much worth monitoring, because if it fails in the region of the trend mean and breaks down once more, well, then we conclusively have a top, and that is potentially a lead indicator for the wider market, considering that it was one of the best performers off the lows in 2009. When we think about the stock market generally, then we know that we've just had a somewhat larger pullback. And when we look at, for example, the S&P 500, it has had some bouts of volatility in the past. It certainly had one in 2015. It lost consistency at the penultimate high and in 2014, and then went sideways for the next year and a half. And then we had this much sharper pullback to unwind the really rather steep overextension and acceleration that we had at the end of last year. And now we're in this ranging phase for the S&P 500, and it was again in positive territory this week. So it has demonstrated support in the region of the trend mean on successive occasions. I think a lot of people, and what I find particularly interesting, is that when the price was back here at the lows, a lot of emails were coming through, and people were worried that it was the thing that had that most people had to pay particular attention to was the cyclically adjusted PE ratio. And when we look at that cyclically adjusted PE, well, we can see that it hasn't been this high since 2000, and previous to that, it had never been as high as it was in 1929. Arguably, well, there are a number of different points about this chart that I think are really very relevant. The first is that it's not a timing tool, that when the valuations got above the Black Tuesday peak in, and hopefully we'll be able to see this, but it's not going to track the mouse, but it was probably somewhere around 1995. Well, the market went on substantially beyond that. It wasn't until the PE ratio had really started to turn around that we really had some indication that something meaningful was happening, and that would have been with a substantial lag compared to the absolute price. We also know that companies' earnings are much more international now than they were previously, so that is an important factor, and that may help to, I think, justify that we do have generally higher valuations since the 1990s until now. Then, of course, because it's not a timing tool, there is the possibility that the PE ratio continues to go higher, that it goes back up to where it was in 1999 or even higher than that, and then pulls back. Well, if it pulls back from those kinds of elevated levels, we are going to have a crash. Then this is an important, I think, ratio for telling us where are we in the cycle. It tells us only one thing, though, is that we're not early. It does not tell us how late we are in the cycle, even though valuations are already quite high by historical standards. What people were worried about, what we're writing about this week, was which company is going to be the one that reaches $1 trillion first. Well, Apple right now is at $942 billion. So, considering that Amazon is going up rather quickly, but it is still, I think, at about $850 billion. So, Apple is now currently somewhat overextended relative to the trend mean. But the very fact that people are asking which company is going to become the first $1 trillion company now is more a testament to the fact that the market has been rallying rather strongly over the last few weeks. I personally think that this is a medium-term correction in an otherwise a relatively consistent medium-term bull market. We had an acceleration within the trend in January. It could have kept going and turned into the acceleration that ended the market. It was more like an acceleration. And now the possibility is that the market will break on the upside. Part of the reason that I reached that conclusion is because the Russell 2000 has already broken on the upside, and mid-caps all over the world are doing better. If we look at the FTSE 250, it also broke on the upside. The MDAX in Germany has also been exhibiting relative strength. It's not quite at a new high, but it is certainly well above the trend mean. And if mid-caps are generally doing better, well, they're generally representative of the regular economy, and that's could be considered good news. The clear leadership in the market is the Nasdaq, and that also has posted new all-time highs this week. So I think it is due some consolidation. I think that the most likely scenario is that with everybody considering when is are we going to get the next or the excuse me the first $1 trillion company, that there is perhaps just a little bit too much bullishness around right now, and that the most likely scenario is we do get some consolidation. Then when we look at where might the market be going? Well, I think it is reasonable just to simply draw the conclusion that the Nasdaq 100 is populated primarily by software companies, and the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index is populated by the hardware producers. Well, hardware producers are consolidating in the region of their 2000 peak. The Nasdaq 100 has already cruised through its 2000 peak. It's substantially above it right now. Well, that does hold out the prospect that the semiconductors index will be able to sustain a move on the upside and will continue to play catch up. Well, if we think about enabling technologies, certainly battery technology is an enabling technology. 5G is another enabling technology. It's something that is going to revolutionize the telecommunications sector. And it is, I think, an enabling technology that will realize the promise of the Internet of Things. It will also realize the potential of autonomous vehicles. With the much faster connectivity speeds, then that will allow communication not only between cars, but also between cars and a hub. And then that will allow for centralized, or I guess it would be distributed traffic technology. We also have that on a voluntary, we already have it on a voluntary basis with the Waze app, and there is the potential that could be rolled out to just about every vehicle. And that would be particularly enabled by the evolution of 5G. Well, then we have the healthcare sector. And the immuno-oncology sector is rapidly advancing, and it is being enabled by the exponential pace of innovation that we're getting in genetic sequencing and genetic editing. Both of those trends are contributing to this pace of innovation that we're getting in oncology. Oncology is the really big number in healthcare spending. It's approximately $1 trillion a year on a global basis. And immuno-oncology has already been very successful in combating leukemia because it's a blood-borne virus, cancer. Well, by tailoring viruses, they can now start to apply this same type of technology to killing off solid cancers, and that represents approximately 90% of the total number of cancers. So, when we think about it in those terms, there is the realistic possibility that through technological innovation, we're going to get a cure for cancer within the decade. And again, that when we think about what is it that can drive a secular bull market, well, technological innovation has got to be up there. And that's why it's continuing to outperform. That's why the cloud computing sector has been so beneficial in terms of the stock market performance. That and I think that that is another enabling technology. So when we go back and think about where are we in terms of the market cycle, we have to at least pay some due consideration to the fact that there is no secular bull market is not punctuated by an occasional bear market. And we get cyclical bears within secular bulls, and we are in a secular bull market. Now, we are also that we're 10 years into an expansion, so eventually we are going to get a much larger correction. We're going, and that will represent really, I think, a key buying opportunity, most particularly within the technology sector. There are challenges that lie ahead, and the rising geopolitical tensions are certainly out there. And one of the most unloved sectors that we have right now is gold. And gold prices have been dithering around the $1,300 area for the last 4 weeks. The most important thing on this chart, to me at least, is the massive reaction against the prevailing trend in 2016. And we have this rounding characteristic to the pattern over the last 5 years. Well, the only time that we've seen anything that's like that in recent history has been all the way back in the period between 1997 and 2002. It took a number of false dawns, but eventually the market broke out and then it had a really significant rally. And I think that we may not get 10 years of consecutive advances on this occasion, but that the most likely scenario is that gold will break above $1,400 and then rally from there. One of the things that I'm particularly heartened by is the fact that silver has been uncharacteristically inert. And the fact that it has been ranging in this tight manner between $16 and $17 since February suggests to me at least that when it breaks out, it is going to do so in a very dynamic manner. And that is equally true of other commodities in this situation, that platinum has really been debilitated by the fact that the diesel scandal is reducing the demand for those kinds of vehicles, but it's now right at the lower side of its range, around $900. Well, considering that gold is at $1,300 and platinum is at $900, that on in the jewelry market, that you should not be paying more for a gold ring or for a platinum ring now than you would a gold ring. That on a spot basis, even given the densities. And the fact that platinum is sold on a 95% purity basis and gold on an 18 carat basis, platinum is cheaper. So that's an important characteristic for this market, that we have this relative value argument that if gold does in fact rally, then it should take the other precious metals with it. And when we think about what the risks are out there, that there is a risk that we are going to have rising populist tensions, that is inherently inflationary. That technological innovation is, I think, from all the research I've been doing, that the clear argument and the question that people have been asking me for years is, when is a robot going to take my job? But if we look at countries like South Korea and Japan and Germany, it's not so much about when is a robot going to take my job. It should be when am I going to get a robot so that I can save my job. That, I think, is the much better way of thinking about that argument, because there is, I think, a growing question about globalization, that the price that's been paid for globalization has been too high. There was an assumption that if China could be brought up to a GDP per capita of approximately $5,000, that liberalism and democracy would naturally flower, and that has not been the case. What has happened has been there has been a massive transfer of wealth to China, and not much has come back in return. So that is, I think, one of the biggest threats that is outstanding. It is a very large question, and considering that all of the disparate populist tensions that are emerging, not just in emerging markets but in developed markets, they have a common thread. And it is not I think, a revolt against technology, but rather a revolt against the status quo. And I think the reduction of the human experience to numbers has not helped. So that's where I think one of the risks is. It's probably going to contribute to more volatility. But I think with that, probably given you enough to think about for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.